son Grady was 4 years old, one evening at the dinner table, he casually asked, "Mommy, can I lose my soul?" I responded very thoughtfully, "Well, The kids that age, at four, are beginning to make meaning out of the religious stories and images, but they typically do this in a very literal way. So Grady believed he had a soul because his parents and in church we taught him that he did, but having never seen it or heard it or smelled it or touched it, he wondered if perhaps it was lost. Was it misplaced? Had it fallen out of his pocket like a favorite rock when he wasn't paying attention? Can I lose my soul?" And after that profound beginning, the answer, we assured him that no, he could not lose his soul. He was tucked safely inside of who God has created him to be. And it would not just fall out and be lost. But his simple yet oh so complicated question, it stuck with me. So he needed to be reassured that this treasured piece of himself had not been lost. But I knew as an adult, from my experience, that it is possible to lose a part of ourselves. Our souls, per se, might not slip out of our pockets when we're not paying attention, but it is possible to become so disconnected from our true selves, from the persons that God has created us to be, that we become lost to ourselves, to the point where maybe we no longer remember who we are or who we were created to be. And in this way, might this be a way of losing the soul, or at least feeling lost from it? This question, this simple wondering of a child, is what echoed in my heart and my mind as I read the words of Amos that I read to you just now. A little bit of backstory. The book of Amos was the first of its kind. Many scholars date it to around 760 before the Common Era, but there's a lot that led up to that point. So the highlights go like this. You guys might know a little bit of this, but bear with me. The highlights are there was a family that had a special relationship with God. This special relationship was a privilege. But this privilege came with great responsibility, chief of which was to be a blessing and to be different from everyone around them in their care, the family's care for the widow, the orphan, the immigrant, and the poor in their midst. Eventually, this special family makes their way to Egypt during a time of famine. There they prosper. They prosper so much that the Egyptians don't like it one bit, and now they make this very large family slaves. The family cries out to God. God sees their oppression and hears their cries. Next, there came a series of plagues, which culminated in the death of the firstborn sons across the land. God's family, as you may remember, was spared as God passed over them. The people were set free from slavery, but unexpectedly found themselves wandering around in the desert for 40 years, waiting to enter the land that God promised them. So long, very long story short, they get there, things go all right for a while. There are 12 tribes in this family, and a series of judges serve as the de facto leaders, and eventually that doesn't go so well, and so the people, now no longer a big family, ask for a king, and God gives them one. He's all right at first, but then not so much, so God gives them another king, and this one is meant to be a king after God's own heart. What a lovely sentiment, but it's kind of a mixed bag. And not much later, the people start fighting each other. They split and form two separate kingdoms. The northern kingdom is called Israel, the largest city in that region being Samaria. And the southern kingdom, the largest city in that, called Judah, the largest city in that region called Jerusalem. Now, if you weren't paying attention to this point, you hear me talking about people from the north and the south and kingdoms fighting. No, I'm not talking about Game of Thrones. This is the Bible here. But there are perhaps some unfortunate similarities. Now, back to our story. The kings, by this point, are not following God or serving as God's representatives. They're not leading the people to honor God and God's most basic commandment, that to be different from the nations around them by caring for the widow, the orphan, the immigrant, and the poor, those on the margins of their society. So God finds yet another way. And it's in this time of divided kingdoms, when we see the rise of the prophets and the prophetic tradition, and Amos, who we just heard from, was the first. He was from Judah, though. He was a southerner who traveled north. I can relate. He came during the reign of King Jeroboam to the northern kingdom. He was sent by God to proclaim loud and clear the thing that nobody wanted to hear. The people of Israel had enthusiastically claimed their privilege, but had in equal measure heartily neglected their responsibility. God's people, whose formative story we've just heard is that of being oppressed and then set free, had now become the oppressors. Amos addresses the people of Israel as you who trample the needy and bring ruin to the poor of the land. There had been a complete breakdown of the court system in Israel. The wealthy put luxury and convenience above justice, their own comfort over truth. Perhaps the most famous indictment in this entire book goes like this. God says, "Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." And I wonder, how did the people of Israel get there? How did they get to the point from being a people trampled to the ones doing the trampling? And when you think about it, I bet it was little by little. Maybe they set little bits of their soul, little bits of their identity down along the way with little choices to become more disconnected from God, little choices that distance them from themselves. I imagine it started small, with seemingly insignificant ways that elevated privilege over responsibility. And over time, I imagine their sense of entitlement grew, along with the riches of the wealthy, all at the expense of the most vulnerable in their society. And God did what God always does. God heard the cries of the oppressed, and God set out to make it right. For wherever the helpless are mistreated, God is offended. The difference here is that it was God's own people doing the offending and the oppressing. And God speaks through Amos using some of the people's most treasured and formative stories. If you'll remember from what I read, God says that he will pass through the people, but he will no longer pass over them, as he had long ago in Egypt. The book of Exodus calls Israel God's firstborn son. And Amos is saying here that this passing through will be like the death and the mourning of God's firstborn son. These people have become no different from the nations around them, and so their fate will be the same. There will be famine, and they know famine. They've known famine before, but not like this. This will be a hunger and a thirst for a word from God, a desperate longing for connection with God, with each other, connection with who they really are. And this is the most pitiful image of the entire book for me. The image of God's people wandering from sea to sea, longing for a word from their God, searching for the truth that they exchanged for their own comfort. They'll search for bits of their soul that they've left behind, trying desperately to remember who they were. Who are we? Their special connection with God in Amos is lost. And so is their identity as God's people. They've lost themselves. And they would quite literally and sadly be lost to exile before long. About 40 years after the book of Amos was written, that's exactly what happened. The Assyrians killed the bulk of the people of Israel, and they took the rest of them as slaves. Some fled south, which, like its northern sister, would be captured and taken into exile 200 years later. This is a sad and difficult part of our story. And if you read the book, Amos says all of this, if you read the whole book, with what seems to be a dramatic flair for violence and gore and widespread destruction and death and desolation in true prophetic form. And I'm wondering, does that make anyone else uncomfortable? Because if I'm being honest, I have to admit that the prophets, Amos included, make me squirm. His words are hard to understand, and they're hard for me to swallow, and it's just downright strange at times. And it's easy to bury these words somewhere deep in our Bible, to sweep them under the church rug and forget that they're even there. I mean, I'd rather stick with the Beatitudes, right? What are you? I like the parts about love and peace and comfort, or Mary and Martha. It would have been much easier to preach from Mary and Martha. Who doesn't love a good Mary and Martha sermon? But Amos, it's tough. And what do we do with these tough parts of our story? Rather than try to figure it out, we often choose to forget. And I think this is part of what human beings do. It's part of human nature that to wiggle out of whatever painful and uncomfortable places we find ourselves. And if we learn anything from Amos, it would seem that human beings, and the people of God included, have been choosing comfort over truth for a very long time. And I ask myself, what is it about the book that makes me so uncomfortable? Is it the wrath of God that leads to death and destruction? Or is it the gross mistreatment of the most vulnerable by God's people? I fear it's the former. What's so difficult is that it doesn't end well for Israel. Not that Israel was oppressing the vulnerable, because we sadly, I fear, have become used to that. The cries of the oppressed are so many and so loud for so long that I wonder sometimes if we even hear them anymore. But God is doing and will do what God always does. God hears the cries of the oppressed and sets out to make it right. So you see, God's always been an advocate. This truth stretches the arc of the biblical narrative. It goes without question. The question, however, is, will we, perhaps both individually and collectively, will we as the church and part of God's people today, will we be among the oppressors this go around? Will we join in when those around us chant, "Send her back"? Probably not. Probably not for most of us here. But we might, perhaps even more dangerously, remain silent while the chants echo around us. Will we ignore the openly racist language, behavior, and system, saying, "Not here, not now"? Or will we stand with our neighbors in our own city when they tell us, "Yes, here, yes, now"? Will we listen to the brave voices from the margins, those prophets who are calling us back, even now, back to God, back to ourselves, before we are beyond recognition, before we are lost? Will we listen to the voices who can lead us back to the bits of our soul we've left along the way? But in order to do this, we have to do the hard work of remembering. For it's often the most painful moments, the most difficult parts of our story, the ones we would rather forget, that are the most formative. A former seminary professor of mine tells the story of growing up in the Deep South during the Civil Rights era. He remembers the all-male deacons of his all-white church linking arms across the front steps of his church rather than to allow a person of color in the door. I grew up in Mississippi, and I'm ashamed of stories like this. But Malcolm X once said, "Mississippi is anywhere south of the Canadian border." So I offer up to you another story. I listened recently to an interview with Gwendolyn Baker, an Ann Arbor native, distinguished teacher in our public schools, and a faculty member at the U. And she, in this interview, remembers growing up here in Ann Arbor as an African-American in the Civil Rights era. She tells the story of saving her money to buy a sundae at Griffin's Drugstore on Main Street when she was a kid. On the day she showed up to order it, there was a little white girl there too. Her sundae came first. It was beautifully done in a dainty glass bowl. Gwendolyn gets excited. It's her first sundae ever. And hers comes in a paper cup. A cup that could be thrown away so no one else would have to use it. In other words, so that white children would not have to share the same bowl. And this is Ann Arbor during the Civil Rights era. These stories, as uncomfortable as they make us, are part of who we are. And it's easier, oh so tempting, right, to bury them deep in the past, to sweep them under the church rug and forget they're there. Because remembering is hard work. And we know that we like to be comfortable, so we often choose forgetfulness. I've been thinking a lot about forgetfulness after reading the novel The Buried Giant by Katsuo Ishiguro. It's set in medieval England, just after the magical time of King Arthur. And its main characters are an elderly couple who wake up one morning to the realization they have forgotten something immensely important about themselves. They've lost their son. But they can't remember who he is or where he went or what happened. We later discover the reason they can't remember is through some kind of an evil magic. A dragon's breath causes a mist of forgetfulness. This takes their bad memories, this mist, but it takes their good memories too. So the couple sets out to find their son, and along their way, they find themselves. They find their memories. This is an arduous journey. It's physically and emotionally demanding. It's a journey of remembering. And as they near the end of their journey, a priest asks the wife. He asks her, "Are you certain, good mistress, you wish to be free of the mist? Is it not better that some things remain hidden from our minds? Is it not easier to rest in forgetfulness? Isn't it easier to forget than to deal with the parts that are hard?" Well, I say that forgetfulness is a luxury of the oppressors, because how can the oppressed ever forget? So to forget these stories is another way of choosing our comfort over truth, because they're a part of us. These memories, individually and collectively, are a part of our soul. And to forget the hard parts is to forget how we've gotten here today, right now. It's to lose a part of ourselves. Because these painful moments, these stories we sweep under the rug, they will shape us. They will inform and reform our future if we let them, if we do the hard work of remembering. Much later than the words that I read you, Amos, earlier, much later than that, there was an ending added to the book. The Northern Kingdom had already fallen, its people long dead and exiled, and these words added perhaps even after the Southern Kingdom had fallen too. Someone came along and added this, and this is how the book of Amos ends. "The time is surely coming, says the Lord, when the one who plows shall overtake the one who reaps. The treader of grapes, the one who sows the seed. The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel, and they shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant them upon their land, and they shall never again be plucked up out of the land that I have given them, says the Lord your God." So after all that loss, after a people lost to God and to themselves, God restores and the people rebuild. Perhaps this final passage in Amos is saying, the time is coming when God will restore our soul and we will remember. And in that remembering, we will rebuild the places that were ruined and lost. Our soul roots grow deep and strong. Lush vineyards, gardens, and golden fields grow. But it's not watered but justice that brings this growth. In order to get to this place, in order to get to that ending, it is the justice rolling down and the righteousness freely flowing that will bring life to the people of God again. May it be so. Amen.